Hi, it is Sunday, the 29th of September, 2012. This is Wes Fryer, and I am driving with my wife, Shelley, back from Colorado Springs to Oklahoma City, and we have finished listening to the Steve Jobs biography, and Shelley got to listen to most of it. I had been listening to it. We've kind of listened to it on different trips, so it's in three parts. And I'm not sure. Did you get into the second part?
Yeah, I got into the second
a little
part,
bit.
But maybe not.
Not most of it. So anyway, she kind of listened to the first third and the last third, and I listened to the whole thing. And so, anyway, I wanted to record a little short podcast of reflections about things that we kind of took away from the book, and we've written down a few different ideas, and so we'll just kind of see how this goes. So I guess to start out with, I'll ask you the question I asked, you know, in advance. Why would you recommend this book to people, and why do you think it might be a good book or not a good book for people to read?
Oh, see, this is the part I don't like, being asked questions. Oh, I've told the microphone. I think definitely I would recommend the book, and I think definitely I enjoyed listening to it, maybe versus reading it. It was interesting. I think it was the audiobook was read by the actual author, and I think that's interesting, having his take on things. I would recommend the book, because I think a lot of times we tend to take our Apple products for granted. Wes will talk later about all of his personal connections with Apple technology, and there is a lot with our families, and you know, we could relate to like the beginning Apple computers. And I remember my dad's been using Apple computers since the original Apple GS, and so I mean, it's definitely been a big part, Apple products, in our family for many years. But I think we've tended to almost idolize those, or maybe even take those for granted, and to see the process in which all of that was created was not only very interesting, but very enlightening, because it wasn't necessarily always a pretty picture.
And I think, well, you know, we talked about this, that it speaks to the power of individuals to make a difference, you know, because this, we wouldn't have, I think we can say for sure, we wouldn't have Apple, we wouldn't have the products if it hadn't been for Steve Jobs. And while he wasn't the inventor of everything, you know, and it's not fair to give him all the credit and, you know, put him on a pedestal, it's also true that this wouldn't have happened without him. And so I think that's a heartening thing, because good leadership matters in so many different contexts. And I'm not saying that Steve's leadership was good in all cases, but leadership makes a huge difference, and individuals make huge differences. So we kind of categorize the things we might talk about into a few groups. And one of the big ones, I think, was just about his extreme personality and kind of talking about that. But then also maybe talking about some personal lessons and things that we can draw from his story. And I guess, do you want to, you talk, yeah, are you a willing participant? She was really given the option to opt out of this and has chosen to be stretched, and Shelley is not used to doing podcasts in the car. I actually haven't done one in a long time either. But, well, I'll ask you in a little bit about the ask myself, why don't you ask me some questions? All right, well, I forgot what I was going to say. That's why I wrote stuff down. Well, okay, personal connections to technology. You know, this was a very different biography to listen to. And we could say read. I mean, it's a weird thing when you listen to books, you say, oh, I read that book. And it, you know, you didn't, but you consumed it. So anyway, I've never read or listened to a biography that I had so many sort of milestone life posts, or, you know, like times in my life that I kind of benchmark, oh, yeah, well, that time I was doing da-da-da. And it's not just that, oh, this is what I was doing in, you know, 1997 when Steve returned to Apple. It was also, you know, oh, yeah, I remember that product and that, you know, and we have that. And so in terms of, you know, personal connections to Apple, I remember my uncle, Ron Henley, in the, I guess, late 80s, you know, being a real convert and, oh, you should use Apple. And so we had a Zenith computer at home and, you know, just kind of regarded him as really weird. And, you know, why would we want to do that? Everyone uses Windows. And, you know, so I grew up using DOS. And used Framework, was a program before Microsoft Office, or just probably right when Office was coming out. And I'd like to write a reflection about my 20th reunion and some of the different things from being at the Air Force Academy. And one of the things that we talked about and laughed about, you know, we were the first class to get computers that had 3.5-inch, what we called floppy drives, and you know, the internet was at its dawn. I mean, it just starting. We had an intranet within the wing, you know, that could send email. But anyway, my starting with Apple was when I went into education in 95, and then 96. And that's when I was a student teacher. Anyway, started out with, you know, 580 computers, LC580s that our elementary school in Lubbock had, the PTA had bought, so kids could take accelerated reader tests, you know, and then buying my first Apple, actually with the help of my parents, who helped buy several different computers that I had through the years, was a Performa 6300, and that was, you know, probably in 95, and starting to get into using ClarisWorks and this visual environment for drawing and curriculum. And eventually I got my first PowerBook. Shelley has the first PowerBook ever that was created. Her dad, you know, got that for her and had set that up. We still have that, although the monitor doesn't, there's a little wiring connection. But anyway, the first PowerBook 100, you know, the first one that we ever had. I had the first iPod ever created. I was working at Texas Tech University then, and I remember, you know, we were still in our old building, which is at where the administration building is now. And I remember, you know, getting the purchase order permission and going over to, you know, to purchase that. And it was, you know, it's a hard drive that's inside this enclosure, but how incredible that was. You know, they marketed it as 1,000 songs in your pocket, but that experience of having that first bit of personal technology and the shift to mobile, and then, you know, the iMac that came out, my parents, you know, getting iMacs. And I remember before the days of the Apple Store being it was demo days at CompUSA. And CompUSA is not even in business anymore. But Steve Jobs didn't want, you know, just Apple computers sitting on the shelf with the same salesman just, you know, treating them kind of as an equivalent widget to anything else. So that was some kind of a marketing campaign that they came up with, and we had swag and shirts that we wore and went some Saturdays to work at CompUSA and, you know, show people the iMac when it first came out, and iMovie, and here's how you could make a movie. And, you know, and now we've got iPhones, and you know, all of our kids have an Apple device. We've got inherited ones and, you know, used ones that the younger ones have. And it's been such an important part of my life and my identity as somebody who believes in teaching different and being different as far as education. Somewhere in our garage, I don't know if these still exist. I remember probably in 97, when I was teaching fourth grade, making some really crummy quality movies because I was having to export it from this, was a Performa probably 5400 computer back to VHS tape. But anyway, trying to enter it in to show, you know, how we were thinking differently and using Alpha Smart keyboards back in the day for students to be typing in the writing workshop, and we were publishing stuff and getting comments on, you know, blogs and stuff. And anyway, it was a completely different experience listening to this biography because of all these personal connections to the technologies that were described. You know, the Apple One and the Apple Two, not so much, although the Apple IIe's were still in the computer lab when I started teaching in the mid-90s. And, you know, I am personally thankful. I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk here about Steve Jobs and his extreme personality, and there's, you know, things that we kind of wonder, well, did he have to be that way? And, you know, real harsh and mean and things. But I am just really personally appreciative of, you know, the fact that Apple brought its products to market, and also, right, and the marketing campaign too. You know, when they tell the story of the Be Different campaign, I mean, I still have all of those posters. I laminated them. They were in my classroom. You know, Alexander has some of them in his bedroom now, you know, with Einstein and some of the others. I think I took on some of those beliefs about the crazy ones. So it's really different than just a sort of academic, you know, read the biography, because I feel very personally connected to this Apple story, as I'm sure a lot of people do, and if we, you know, kind of tie in our lives at different phases. What has been your connection to Apple computers in your family?
Well, I mean, I think you said a lot. You had your Uncle Ron, but I had my dad. And my dad, as a band director at Matthews Junior High in, you know, Lubbock, Texas, I remember had an Apple computer in his office. And that's when he began keeping his, you know, I don't know, grade book and all kinds of stuff on. And, you know, that was eons ago. That was at the very beginning, and he didn't come from a techie background. However, he was very smart and very intelligent, and the Apple computer was just easy to use. And it was more for everybody. You didn't have to be an engineer or a mathematician or anything else. It was the ease of use. And so Apple computers have been a part of my life for a very long time. And Dad went on to become a computer teacher at the middle school, and of course used all Apple products, and we've always had Apple products in the home. So at a time where people still thought, you know, you only weirdos used Apple products, you know, I mean, nowadays, you know, everybody, it's not as strange. I mean, everybody carries an Apple laptop and an Apple device, and I think we'll talk later about how, you know, Steve Jobs created an environment where everything was seamless and easy to use and interconnected, and you know, they had a few glitches here and there, but the company was always willing to make it work. That put a lot of effort into making everything work together, as it should. And we will talk about later, I think Wes has some ideas on talking about, where was it? Oh yeah, the openness versus closed. Apple computers have been a part for a long time of my family, and it's just a part of our family identity.
So that's, I guess, a good recommendation for anyone who, you know, has had any kind of connection. You'll probably enjoy that in a similar way as far as thinking about your own life and the ways of those products. Because one of the things about Apple technology and technology probably in general is at some point you notice it and people point to it and they're like, oh, look, you have that, you know, and it's flashy and it's different. But good technology disappears. It becomes just what you do, what you use, how you work. In fact, that's kind of a frustration in some ways now, because in different contexts, you know, sometimes people look at me and they see the technology. They're like, oh, yeah, it's the technology person or whatever. It's like, no, I'm not a technology person. I use these tools, but I'm, you know, there's all these other things I'm into besides just these tools. So anyway, I think that tools are important. And the thing, it's not like it's sometimes I guess it's what you wear. You know, people have an iPhone or they have something like that as a status symbol. And, you know, of course the digital divide's real, and there's lots of people that don't have access to the internet. They don't have a smartphone of any kind or laptop. But, you know, the world has really changed quickly in just the last decade as far as, you know, how Apple is regarded and the pervasiveness that Apple technology has in the world. And so, I don't know. I guess it's what I'm trying to say is it's more powerful than just wearing a label. It's not like I'm just wearing, you know, my daughter wears an Aeropostale shirt. It's different than that, you know, because it's part of who I am. It's part of how I interact with the world. If I didn't have these powerful tools at my fingertips to be able to literally be an extension of my mind, I mean, just what we're doing right now, where we've got an iRig microphone plugged into an iPhone, and, you know, when we're back in 3G, we'll, you know, click a button, and it'll post up to the web and go on our family learning blog. I mean, there's incredibly, we might call it magic, but it's, you know, there's engineering, it's technology. There's incredible power here, and this has affected the things that I do, and therefore the person I am. I don't know. And that just, that's a big theme for me listening to the whole biography. And so there's, you know, while I certainly think we feel some, you know, some criticism or judgment of, you know, things that, ways that Steve treated people and things like that, there's definitely a huge overlay of thankfulness because, you know, absent these tools, I would be a different person. And that is absolutely not an exaggeration. So let's talk a little bit about extreme personality. So we wrote down a bunch of different things. I'm going to pass the mic to my wife. Yes, it's your turn. Because it's more interesting to hear more than one person talk. If it was just me, everyone would have shut down. But they're hearing your melodious voice, and you're making this podcast wonderful for us all. So why did we call this extreme personality as a section?
All right. Well, I think definitely there's an element of mental disorder, for lack of a better term. I mean, narcissistic. Yeah, I mean, kind of just really off the charts, I think. And probably the success of Apple has a lot to do with his extreme personality, whether it was from, you know, just, oh my goodness, you know, never bathing, never thinking he smelled bad in his younger days, you know, his extreme eating perfection diets. I mean, you know, I'm sure it was some type of eating disorder, to not ever wearing shoes, to, I mean, just very, very extreme personality issues, and I think sometimes some of that enabled him to, because he was very harsh. I mean, you know, he had definite opinions on whether it was food or your personality or the way you interacted with the world, and he could tell you like it was from his perspective, you know, and use of mood swings, you know, going from very intense anger to very intense crying to very, you know, just an incredible laying on the yeah, I mean, so, I mean, you know, and I think therein lies some of the I don't want to say disillusionment, but the idolizing thinking, oh, well, Steve Jobs, he's got a lot of money, he's got a fabulous company. I think the way that he got there was huge. Wes says, I have to talk into the microphone now. but I don't know.
Well, one of the things they talk about is the, what is it, personality distortion field? You know, Steve was an incredibly charismatic person. And, you know, one of the things I feel really fortunate, and at the, kind of the end of the book, I didn't know him, but I did get to hear him in 2007 give the Macworld keynote when he showcased the iPhone. When the iPhone was announced, I was there in San Francisco on, like, I don't know, maybe the 20th row or something, pretty close. And I actually did have a chance also, maybe it was it before that? Maybe it was that later that same year to hear Alan Kay, who was at Xerox PARC and had helped, you know, create the visual graphical user interface. So it's cool to be able to have had some experiences directly listening to these people. Even that, you know, you don't get a sense for what's described in the book with this the reality distortion field, that's what they called it, you know, and so his ability to stretch people and go beyond what they thought was possible, whether that was what was possible time-wise because we only had this many weeks or this many months, or whether it was, you know, through the engineering. And so, yeah, with the design stuff. And there's all kinds of examples with glass and what they call it, Gorilla Glass, with the iPhone, and just lots and lots of different design things that really pushed the envelope. So his extreme personality and his perfectionism was definitely a huge piece of the puzzle. And the way in which, you know, he experienced failure but rebounded. I don't think you heard much of the Pixar story, but I really enjoyed that about, you know, how Pixar came to be and this intersection of art and technology, like Apple. One of my biggest takeaways from that part was about the whole idea of designing spaces so that you have unplanned encounters and bumping into people, and that creativity is so much about not planned but still possibly intentional. Because I've heard stories of Bell Labs and how, you know, engineers that were eating lunch together, you know, were swapping, what are you doing? Here's what I'm doing. And then I think radar actually came out of that kind of a conversation, or maybe it was the microwave, and being able to use microwaves in different ways. So the ways, and, you know, they tell the story of designing the Pixar building and how they set it up. They did have, I guess, bathrooms in two different areas, but they wanted that main atrium to be where the food was, the cafeteria, and the bathroom. And because you were going to have to, you know, get up and out of your box, and you were going to run into people, and you'd bump into them, and you'd talk, and, you know, the work I'm doing this year in UConn schools, you know, sharing an office again with Adam Zodro, who's our PD guy. It's awesome. I love being able to interact, and, you know, it's not that you plan all those things every day. Sometimes they just happen, but I guess a lot of benefit came out of that design of spaces and wanting to help people be creative.
I think something that just made me think of too is how important it is to surround yourself with people that complement your personality. You know, he had people around him who got him and understood him and protected him and dealt with his issues. I mean, you know, he had people who were responsible for, I mean, whether it was their job or just something that they did, who understood him well enough to hold him accountable, but also to deal with the people who he treated very harshly, you know. So then later on, you know, in his life, his wife, who definitely complimented his personality and understood him and supported him and loved him, and his children as well, who... you know, they understood who their dad was and loved him because of it, even though he was an extremely difficult person. And his friends who, and even his competitors who, you know, especially towards the very end of his life, you know, respected him for who he was, whether they liked his style of doing things or whether they had, you know, interactions with him in the past. But I think definitely people... saw his genius and his talent, and whether they agreed with it or not.
Well, and so kind of on the whole personality thing, I guess one thing that's interesting about that is we've got lots of people asking about creativity and STEM, and, you know, how do we get more engineering? What does STEM stand for? Science, technology, engineering, and math is what STEM stands for. And so how do we, you know, have more kids excited about STEM, about science, about doing engineering, and how do we get more folks to go to school to study those things? And that's near and dear to my heart because a lot of reasons. I've got, you know, kids, some of whom are interested. One, you know, 9-year-old who's really excited about science and really wanting to learn and hasn't been shut down by a teacher or a school environment or culture, you know, into thinking that she can't do it or that it's not fun. But we've also got a STEM program in UConn and for 4th and 5th grade students, and actually at one of our elementaries, a K-3 STEM program too. you know, China. We've Shelley and I have been to a conference in Hangzhou for higher ed, and a big focus was about creativity and, you know, 21st century skills, and how can, you know, these kinds of skills be brought into schools and encouraged rather than just a standardized rote memorization, you know, kind of traditional education. And Steve Jobs is so out of the box, so beyond the corporate, organizational, you know, way of thinking about how people behave, that I think it's really important to remember, you know, because Apple products did not come from, you know, a traditional AT&T corporate. It did not come from IBM corporate. It did not come from Microsoft corporate. You know, this came from people who were very driven and passionate and were not conforming to the norm. And, you know, I think that we really should grapple with how we can encourage creativity, real creativity. And I'm not saying that, you know, we don't shower or wear shoes, and there's all kinds of quirks, and you know, Steve was a unique guy. But what is real creativity, and how do you encourage creativity, and do you shut it down? I think there's probably real good ways that we could, in our classrooms and our families, you know, kind of hold up a mirror to see, what do we do when someone has a different idea, or when somebody proposes a different way of doing things? And anyway, just, it's, Apple computers are coming, they're out of the box. I mean, they define the box now, and our whole conceptions of user interface and an app and how things should be.
Industry is completely reinvented because of Apple iTunes. You know, the cell phone industry is completely redefined by the touchscreen and, you know, a mobile computing device in your pocket. Even the iPad, you know, the race for a tablet computer. Well, the iPad is not, I didn't even view it as a computer. It's a very powerful computer, but it's a reading device, and it's a creating device, and it's a watching device, and it's a gaming device. And I mean, it's become a part of who we are and what we do and how we consume information and how we deal with information. I mean, I don't even use it in probably the most powerful ways that it could be used, but it's just really reshaping. And I don't remember the exact quote in the book, but it's not giving people what they want, it's giving people what they don't even know is possible yet. Showing them what they're going to want, showing them what they're going to need. And I think there's a whole, we had said something about future shaping there. I mean, he has definitely been one to reshape the future.
Okay, so that's a good segue. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, that future shaping. And Steve was willing to take risks and took risks way beyond what a lot of people would do, even when they were very successful. He was never super focused on money and profits. Those came and those followed what he did, but he was very, very passionate about products and not wanting to compromise in his company. And so I think that if we think about takeaways or personal lessons, you know, that's one of them. Not to say that none of us should compromise. And I've heard, you know, that some people are taking the Steve Jobs biography as an excuse for being really cruel and heartless, you know, to their employees and being tyrannical. And, you know, I don't think that's ridiculous. I think there's tremendous room and importance in this world for kindness. And I don't think we should listen to his story, put him on this pedestal, and think that, okay, in order to be creative, we're all going to have to be extreme narcissists that, you know, are really just inwardly focused and tell the harsh, brutal truth no matter what and let the chips fall where they may. That's not true. And I think that his willingness, though, to take risks and to use intuition, and to, I know multiple times Shelley's had better intuition than I about things, and there's some real positive stories here about it. But there's also this huge story about reinvention and failure. Oh my gosh, you know, having a big success, but then cratering down. And as Steve told Isaacson, the author, you know, becoming a beginner again, being stretched to a place where you're doing stuff and it's not completely comfortable because you're in a new environment. But, you know, he was one that really thrived on that. I would say another one of the personal lessons I take away, well, Kevin Honeycutt said it this way when we talked about this, a cautionary tale of family priorities. You know, Steve was not a family guy. He loved his children and his wife, but he was a work guy. And I think it's really, well, we reflect on these kind of things being at a 20th college reunion. You know, a lot of what's most visible for people are their professional accomplishments and you know, what their rank is. In fact, that was one of the few things that they said out loud at our banquet was, oh, we know who the colonels are, but, you know, we have this person who's a 2-star equivalent GS. And then they came up later and said, oh, no, we skipped somebody. They're a 3-star. And that is, it's cool to see that, and it's good to know that. But the world tends to focus a lot more on those professional things. And so I think I agree with Kevin that this is a cautionary tale about family priorities and you know, about personality and the cost that comes with that. I'll also say a personal lesson, I think, is, you know, on the positive side, was his ability to focus. I know I tend to sometimes be pretty scattered with a lot of different irons in the fire and a lot of activities. And, you know, Steve was really passionate about saying, no, we are not doing 100 things. We are going to do several things, and we're going to do them really, really well. And that's going to define who we are. And I really think that's a strong lesson, maybe one of the most important ones that I'm going to take away from the book, is that ability to focus. And it's okay to say no to things and to, I mean, I've heard this in other places. This isn't the first time to be thinking about it, but his story and the story of Apple definitely highlights that, the need to have focus, and then the benefit that can come from having focus and not being fragmented all over. So any thoughts you have about personal lessons or things that you would draw from the story that you think are applicable, you know, personally or to people generally?
No, I just, I know how important it is to have teamwork within a family. And the one thing that I was really impressed with is that Steve did definitely appreciate his wife and what she did for him and how she managed their family and understood him, and I think it a lot of that success comes from teamwork. I mean, you know, a lot of relationship stories are not successful ones, especially when money is involved. And so I credit his wife and all of those who were very close to him as having just as much a part of the success of Apples.
And his is a really unique story, too, about not being transformed into a different person because of money. You know, I think that it sounds like he was pretty much the guy he had been kind of his whole life. I mean, they mention at one point where, you know, when at different points when Apple went public and other things, and people who went and got yachts and had other mansions and all these, you know, staff that they had to take care of and plastic surgeries. And anyway, that I think he remained himself pretty, you know, which is, there's the good side and the dark side of that, you know, through it all. So last thing maybe we'll talk about, unless you have other ideas, was this idea of openness and closed, you know, platform. And it's been really interesting for me personally to work really extensively with Apple products and professionally representing Apple as an Apple Distinguished Educator. Had different phases of my life, and then having my foot in the Google world and becoming a Google certified teacher, and you know, the tension between Apple and Google, or, you know, people could also say the war. I mean, there's a lot of things that are brought to light in this book. I didn't know about Adobe refusing to make Premiere for the Mac, and that's what propelled Steve and Johnny Ive and the Apple group to make iMovie. But also was the resentment he bore towards Adobe was part of them wanting to kill Flash and not support Flash on iOS devices. You know, the extreme, I think you could say hatred, that Steve felt towards Google for Android and for stealing, in his view, the iOS touch interface. It's very similar, of course, to Windows and Microsoft with that ripoff. And there's all kinds of things like that that happen with creativity. But I guess my takeaway at this point is, you know, I'm a big fan of openness and, you know, love WordPress and Moodle. Those are two different examples of open environments that are thriving, you know, creative platforms for content sharing and publication. There's a whole host of different tools that I use. Do you need to stop? Okay. There's a whole host of different tools that that I use that are free, that are open source. But anyway, I guess some people see it, and there's a Cory Doctorow article about that he wrote for Boing Boing that's about, you know, why I won't buy an iPad. And then I don't know the name of this author. I haven't read him yet, but I've heard of this, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. He's at Harvard. And these folks are very rabid, openness advocates. I think after reading this book, you know, I feel more confident and happy in my space of being an advocate for both. I think, you know, yes, there are definite disadvantages to a closed environment and to a closed system. Thankfully, you know, the iPhone thrives with all the apps that have been created. That was surprising to me. I thought one of his lessons learned from his stint at Next Computer, when, you know, hardly anybody developed any software from it, was, oh my gosh, we've got to get developers and we have to win the hearts and minds of developers. That kind of happened accidentally with the iPhone and Apple, because again, Steve didn't want any outside development. He did to pollute his device. I did not expect that. But anyway, I love both, you know. I'm a real big fan of Mac products, and, you know, in many ways they allow me, they work because they're closed, they allow me and many others to be incredibly powerful with ideas and communication in ways that we simply wouldn't be able to. I've had different times of my life where I've, you know, had to go work on a Windows machine and have a platform and try to be productive, and I have not been able to have the fluid abilities to take ideas and to create them digitally and share them. And, you know, I don't want my technology to be a barrier. I want it to be a channel and a bridge. And so I remain a very strong, you know, Apple advocate, but also an advocate of open and sharing. And I think that these worlds are going to continue to coexist. I don't think that either one is going to, certainly in the short term, completely dominate. And, you know, as you look at malware and viruses and what's happened on the Windows platform and just how ridiculous it is of the security threats that people have to put up with. And we've got, a lot more of that happening in the Android, you know, open marketplace world than we do with Apple. It is going to be interesting to see how this evolves. And I guess what I'm saying is I feel really happy and comfortable being an advocate for both, you know, using both, you know, tools in both areas in Google and Apple's world. I won't elaborate in this podcast in detail about some interesting interactions that I've had as a result of having my feet in both worlds. But I don't know. There was a lot of talk about openness versus the closed environment of Apple. And, you know, thank goodness Steve has gave us, along with the Apple team and so many others, the iPhone and the ability to publish with these tools. Because who's going to say what this is going to look like in, you know, 10 years or 20 years? That's another big takeaway, is it's such an exciting day to be alive and such a wonderful time to be an educator and a teacher and a parent. Yes, there's all kinds of challenges, but oh my goodness, we were equipped with such amazing tools and capabilities. I think things that people would have only, I don't even know if they would have dreamed about the things that are now normal that we have. So, do you have a closing thought to share?
No, I'm good.
You're good. Okay. I feel like we should have one more word from you, but you're not going to say anything else. All right, well, that's it. Well, thanks very much to my wife, Shelley, for joining me on this podcast. I'm not sure if she was going to want to do this or not, and she stretched herself. Thank you for stretching yourself. beyond your comfort zone, and we would love to have any comments and feedback that you have. Check out the Steve Jobs biography. We definitely are big fans of Audible.com, and the best way to do Audible, this is not a paid promotional statement, but we have learned that when you're an Audible subscriber, then you end up getting a credit each month, and we actually have, you know, a number of books stacked up here. So who knows, maybe we'll cancel our membership for a while until we listen to, I think we got like 5 books to listen to now. But anyway, it's great, a wonderful way to experience ideas and to be able to share them. And we'd encourage you to share your ideas as well and play with media. Visit playingwithmedia.com for more information. All right. How do I shut this thing off? This is an unedited podcast.